Welcome back to the American Master Chef's Order, AMCO Podcast. I'm Certified Master Chef Gerald Ford, and I'm here today with Master Chef Jason Hall to discuss a Certified Master Chef exam pre-plan. This podcast is recorded in association with South Bend Equipment, Winco Equipment, Colorado Mills Sunflower Seed Oil, and is published under the American Master Chef's Order. And I'm really excited, and I know Chef Hall is very excited to share this with you. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to the show. So welcome back to the AMCO Podcast. I think we've wrapped up quite a few good sessions on the topic of the CMC exam pre-plan, and we're going to start diving into working with the apprentice.
Yeah, thank you. So working with the apprentice is a huge thing, you know. And it takes a little bit of time to realize where you can kind of work them to your best advantage, where you're going to have them when you need them so that you have what you need in order to do your job. One of the most relevant moments, I think, of that was between exams for me, between 10 and 12. And I was doing a practice with Ryan Baxter and Amanda Zimlich and Sean Loving. And we were practicing with Steve Ginta, and he said, you know, he was kind of running through our programs for the next day. And he said, you know, Jason, what are you doing tomorrow? I believe I was doing classical. And I said, yeah, I have 4 hours to, you know, do this. And I was kind of walking through the window. He said, no, you don't have 4 hours. You have 8 hours. And I thought, wow, I can pull this off no problem, chef, if you're giving me an extra 4 hours. But he said, no, you have 4 hours and your apprentice has 4 hours. but really that was another one of those moments where it made all of us have that mental, light bulb go on and say, wow, if you think that you can do this in 8 hours, you absolutely can do it in four if you maximize that person's time. And that was definitely something that I struggled with the first time around. You know, there was times where I felt like I had that person exactly where I needed them as far as a mise en place, point of view goes. There were times when I felt like I had to go over and pick up some work that person was working on because I didn't have what I needed in order to just walk to the stove. And so, that was something that really made me kind of think and dial back how I was writing a prep list for a secondary person. Was I really maximizing his or her time to benefit me? You know, and so my goal really was to be able to come out of butchery and go to the stove and go to the stove and go to the stove with things that this person had already mised for me. And so, you know, when you first look at it, you're going, well, how can I get this person ahead of me? And the simple solution for me was looking at it saying, well, I know that the first thing I have to do every single day is fabrication, because the next step from that is building sauces, you know, roasting bones, developing flavor, so you can maximize and concentrate those flavors throughout the entire day. And, you know, when I...
Yeah, basically everything follows butchery.
Right, everything follows butchery. And what's your goal as soon as you get out of fabrication and starting those sauces that you're going to compound down? So, you know, it might be a tart, it might be, a secondary thing that you're doing with a protein that is immediate, something that you're stuffing with protein so you don't have to, you know, bounce back and forth between veg and then go back and do something else with protein later. So that really let me look at it and say, you know, if my first thing is fabrication, that's somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes. Maybe even a little bit longer than that on your market basket day. But if I can have that person mise en place for me first, what I need when I come out of fabrication in 45 minutes, then I'm going to be able to pick up that tray, go to the stove and cook. The second thing is the second thing, and so on and so forth. So, I did away with, you know, having them do mundane tasks, herbs and all those things. That can be later. You know, there's plenty of time for that person to work on that later on in the day once the big projects are knocked out. And very rarely are you cooking with those those fine herbs, in the very beginning of your process. That's more finishing, etc. So that's how I kind of started to look at it. Was I have this window of time where I can utilize this person to prep. What's the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth thing I need after fabrication? Well, that's their assignments from minute one. You know, as that process goes along and as the day goes along, you're able to keep that person much further, ahead of you.
Right. And that's, I mean, obviously the further they are ahead of you, that's just managing your person and obviously hopping back over when you see that they're not where they need to be. Again, it's just active management of a person who you've never worked with before.
Exactly. And you want to make them feel comfortable, you know, so it's got to be a really clear, concise, list that they're working from, very bullet pointed. Remember that they're also, nervous when they step into this thing. So the more direct their prep list is, the more direct and simplified the instructions are for them, the easier it's going to be for them to produce food for you. And so my list was very small. We had a column on the same page that said chef prep, a column on the same page that said apprentice prep. And so we looked at the same piece of paper. We shared it between us. That way I could see what he or she was doing. You could still keep them involved in what you're doing, even if it is fabrication. You could talk to them about what you're doing and what you're going to do with this muscle and, really ask them detailed questions about the process that they're going through to make sure that it's going to be what you want on the other side. So there's a lot of management of that apprentice that I don't know is really clear in the very beginning when you first look at this. You're definitely scored on how you work with the apprentice in the kitchen as far as the kitchen score goes. So the more that you build that person up and the more that you encourage them through the process and spend time working on this day with them throughout the duration of time, the better that score obviously is going to be. If we see you interacting and giving positive constructive feedback, giving a demo of something that you want to see done, that you're going to put them on that task, you probably need to do that anyways if you're expecting a certain result. But those are the things that we're kind of looking for from a scoring side. So the best way to test those processes when you're in the R&D phase of your program is to use a year one culinary student. As I was speaking about, before Joe Gianzero, who I took with me to the test, I rarely practiced with him because I knew what my results were going to be. I know he would have everything done that I needed to, and then he'd be sweeping floors. I needed to test my plan with someone who was challenged by those things. And so a first-year culinary student who, isn't really sure what they're getting themselves into for the afternoon that you're doing a run is the best, because that's going to really kind of show you where your program is and if there's strengths or weaknesses in it. If they are, for the most part, completing everything and you're getting what you need when you need it, you probably have a pretty airtight system there. Maybe some things to polish up, but remember, you don't know these people, when you arrive at the exam. So you may have a different person every day. You may be lucky enough to have the same person, two or three times, which is a blessing, but, it's a roll of the dice.
Yeah. You absolutely do yourself a disservice if you're practicing with somebody who's on autopilot and who just does what you need them to do. You're really under preparing yourself for the real situation.
Yeah, you're setting yourself up for some failures there, because while the students are very talented, they have they've been vetted to come into to this, and so there's never really any issues with that. The fact that this person has no idea how you cook, they've never seen you cook before, they're probably not familiar with the dish. That's where you need to build that program to be a strength for anybody who steps up to the board. And so, that's just a piece of advice that you need to really start to push that early on, so you don't get too comfortable with the system that you're gonna have get twisted up at the exam.
Did you organize yourself with a tray setup, or how did you set yourself up so that they could work along with you as quickly as possible, right? So they could just fall into integration.
I don't know who originally came up with quote unquote the tray system. I saw Kevin Walker do it for Chef of the Year. I loved how clean and perfectly organized it let him be, so that it let him step to the stove with everything that he needed every single time. And so the tray system simply is, if we're looking at what we just talked about, where we have our apprentice working on a project. Let's say it's, you know, Duxelle stuffed polenta. They have to mise en place all of that. So they're mise en place the mushrooms, the, you know, the Madeira, whatever goes into that, you know, maybe minus some herbs. And so as they're building that, if that's the first project that you need when you come out of fabrication, for instance, they're going to have a tray that's going to be marked polenta stuffed with mushroom Duxelle. And on that tray is going to be a container that's pre-labeled with exactly what goes in it. So if they're looking at a list, you know, and this is where I didn't want to overwhelm my apprentice. I wanted to put all this on myself and my sous chef, quote unquote, back at the hotel. So we would build a tray, a small tray, large tray, depends. And as you cook through the day, those trays kind of collapse down because you're assembling product. So now you have finished things that are going to be rethermed in the oven or gratined last minute. So in the beginning, you're going to have a tray, let's say with this mushroom Duxelle stuffed polenta. And on there, you're going to have a container for the polenta. You're going to have a container for the heavy cream. You're going to have a container for the stock. You're going to have a container for, you know, roasted garlic. You're going to have a container for the mushrooms. You're going to have a container for, you know, the brandy or the Madeira, depending on however your recipe works. And let's say that's our recipe. And so on that tray, it's pre-done. We do that in the hotel the night before. Joe did that for me. I showed him this system and we worked on it at the club. But then when I presented Joe with my recipes every night, he would build these trays for me. So on the polenta tray is all the cups for polenta. All those cups are marked with what goes in it. That sounds like a ton of work, and it is. That's another great reason why you should bring a sous chef. Because if they understand that, it lets you give this apprentice a tray that says polenta. They are looking at a small bullet pointed recipe list that says what to prep for polenta, and they visually see a landing zone for it. The benefit of that is when they put it in the cooler and you say, all right, you know, I'm ready for my polenta. They know where it is because it's marked. You can see visually that everything is already there. Probably you can call out anything that's shortages or, you know, a little bit overage and make those adjustments. The important thing is if that system is adapted to your entire day, which I did for everything, then when I come out of fabrication, I'm grabbing that, I'm stepping to the stove. By the time you get that finished, it's probably going to go on to something else, right? It's going to go into a mold. It's going to go into a different container. I don't know. That's going to go back down into your cooler probably. And so then you're going to ask that person for the next mise en place. They're going to give you the next tray, which is, some sort of stuffed cipollini onion. So you grab this stuffed cipollini onion tray, you step to the stove. It keeps you walking to the stove with the mise en place that you need in order to finish those projects. So you really just keep cooking. But it's a great checks and balances to have a tray that has the containers on it, the name of the recipe on it, and those containers marked with what goes in it, because it's easy for you to look at it and say, yep, that's everything. You can make some little adjustments there, but the important thing is that you're cooking. You can make some adjustments as some of those things are coming up, obviously. And it really gives you a much, much better flow, in my opinion. Now, this is what worked for me. Again, not everything that I do or that, you know, you do, chef, as we discussed, is going to work for everybody. It's just a conversation about a way to stay, you know, very, very strongly organized. You know, there's going to be a hiccup here or there where something's missing, but you can easily adjust that. Or as you're bringing that product together, you can say to your apprentice, I know you're working on my sweet potato tarts. I don't see any roasted garlic here. Can you pull that out from the cooler for me? I mean, it still gives you the benefit of not really, you know, leaving the stove and still having that person able to pull off some quick little things for you.
Well, and I had the benefit. I think I realized, well, actually there was a couple things here, right? Like I remember a conversation with Ken and Ken reminded me, like, look, you can have the best plan and you can have the best organization in the world, but once you're cooking, you're not going to be perfect, right? You're not going to execute this perfect. You're never going to look like you're not making mistakes. But when you put together a program like this or a system, it helps you really narrow down to where your pinch points are, and it helps you control more of the variables that might get in your way or cause you some issue. And it really helps set your apprentice up for the most success, which ultimately helps you be set up for the most in success. And, you know, what most people fail to do is visualize the whole thing. And it's such a powerful tool, right? As you're going through, you know, and you're labeling cups, okay, I'm going to need this much. I'm going to need this much onion. I'm going to need this much onion. I'm going to need onion here, onion here, onion here. Wait a minute. I don't have a cup for onion for, okay, so why not? And it helps you dive in deeper, and then you can kind of lay out your run a little bit more. You really understand your program on a deeper level, and then you can actually visualize yourself through your timeline. You know, it's funny because I think the more you try to prepare, the more you try to push towards an ideal, you know, the closer you get. You're never going to get it exactly, but you're making a lot more progress. You have a much clearer definition of where you're trying to go. And that's the point.
Very much so. You know, it really gives you the time to work on food and still be able to manage any of the things that might fall through with that recipe or something else. And it lets you stay on the stove, right? Because you have all those things working. All your reductions are happening, you know, your stocks are reducing, you know, all those things are up there. So you're better able to manage the processes that are happening up there because you're stepping up with a tray of food to cook every single time.
I just want to hop in there for a second and say, like, that's just such a big point of the MasterChef exam that I think people maybe aren't aware of. But when you're cooking that stove, regardless of how much time you have, you need to be working that stove and brushing the sides of your pots and cooking at the most ideal level that you can. So you really need to spend time at that stove browning things ideally and cleaning your pans ideally and using cartouches and working that stove as a master craftsman would, regardless of the time restraint.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot of work to be done on that. And it's going to occupy a lot of time and it's going to occupy a lot of attention. So the more that you can spend there, you know, the better off, obviously. The better the results are going to be, the better your flavors are going to be. And, you know, I think that's a great plan to work through. As those things come off and start to collapse down, then what I would have, you know, my apprentice, he or she do is build my, okay, this is my salmon tray, this is my salad tray, this is my, so as things come off, you know, I remember someone saying once, well, what do you do with all these, where do you keep all these trays at? Well, if they're just trays that are wrapped in plastic wrap, I cater wrapped them, you know, they were stacked somewhere, it didn't really matter where they were, but they were stacked in order of what they were going to pull. So it was easy for them to grab and fill. And by the time I get out of fabrication, if there's four trays in there, great. But in a few minutes, there's going to be two. So, you know, it does keep it revolving, like a revolving door. And then as that final mise en place comes in for plating, you know, then you're building really a tray per course, which I always called my plate up list. I always called my plating component list was a literal list of everything that needed to be on that tray for plating. So if it was finishing, if it was, you know, zest, et cetera, which is a separate topic. But so that's what I mean by my version of the tray system that's on the handout we're going to have on the website.
It's always best to work with your apprentice by far. That makes everybody's life a whole lot easier. And as you said earlier, the evaluators are definitely looking to see how you work with your apprentice. It's a chef exam, and how you work with your apprentice makes a world of difference.
You've got to work with them, not against them. Understand that they're stressed as well. You know, this might be a nerve-wracking situation for them, but they're excited to be there and they've put themselves, you know, out there to be a part of it and to have the experience. So there's a great opportunity there to encourage them through this process and to see them grow through this process. I may have mentioned that, you know, there's a couple that still contact me every now and then on social media. Hey, chef, I'm doing this. How's things? You know, so you change jobs on LinkedIn or whatever it is. And, but, you know, they're strong cooks in order to step into that kitchen in their role as well. And so that I think there's a lot of respect that has to go along with that. You know, encouraging them in their performance through this is huge. You know, to have a, you know, MasterChef candidate, you know, reward them or shake their hand, tell them they did a great job today. I mean, that carries a lot of weight. You know, we want to see those apprentices in that kitchen as the candidate someday. So there's a lot of goodwill that can come from this. There's a lot of structure that can come from this to a young person that can benefit our entire, you know, designation long term. So encouraging them through, you know, showing them what you're doing, showing them how to do something, telling them great job, a handshake at the end of the day, you know, being excited about them being in there with you and building up that confidence for them. You know, reward them with some taste of things at the end. There's nothing wrong with that. But then also letting them taste everything, you know, as you bring something together, as you finish something, as a sauce is coming off, give them a tasting spoon. Let them be wowed by that moment. That's what they're there for. They're there to be, to experience this and to benefit from it and to be inspired by it. So let that thing kind of happen naturally with your apprentice in the kitchen.
I had a lot of fun with that component, actually, you know, like, you know, walking through and trying not to pull them away, but really trying to make it a coaching moment and saying, okay, do you remember that? Do you remember how I was browning the bones and what I deglazed with and how I reduced that wine down to a point that you hadn't seen before? Now taste how that comes through, you know, and have, I don't know, like that really, that made the test a lot of fun for me at some points. Even it would keep me out of my head, you know, like it put me in that natural state of teaching and mentoring. And you see these students light up and they buy into your program so much more.
Yeah, there's a huge motivating component in there for me as well to show them something, to see, like you said, their eyes light up, to see you put something together and then be wowed by it and talk about it afterwards, or see them go, you know, talk to one of their colleagues about it. You know, and then have those conversations. That's inspiring for me. You know, that is a motivating factor for me to push and keep pushing and come back tomorrow strong and stronger. So, you know, I like to teach. I like to, you know, to work with people. And I think that this slide alone, the apprentice piece alone, can be a hugely beneficial thing, not only for, you know, the apprentice themselves, but also the chef who's in the kitchen and the program as a whole.
Well, and the other side of that sword is if you're not prepared for that component, you're gonna fall short.
Yeah, that's got to be airtight. The entire part of that, they have to be utilized for that entire time period. There really should be no downtime, you know, for them. If there is a few minutes of downtime, it should be, you know, a good quick clean, change the boards, sweep the floor. You know, keeping everything as surgically clean and professional as possible. That's the one instruction I gave them every single morning, was that if there's any moment of downtime, it is an opportunity for us to remain surgically clean, you know, and I always stated it that way, that how, you know, amazing is our station going to look if it's cleaner than it was at the end and when we began. That's a motivational thing for some people to hear. You know, that was my goal every single day, that we were, you know, white tablecloths and beautiful stainless steel and delicious food. That was the goal every single day. And if we could end our run with that box checked, happy with the food, really excited to put up the flavors that we built and, you know, and build that inspiration within the apprentice, then I did my job for the day.
Huge lessons that'll change a career. We've talked about the apprentice. We've talked about the equipment. What would you recommend for practicing to take the test?
Yeah. So practicing is the thing, you know. I just had a conversation with a chef the other day who's excited to take it, is about 2 years out. And he said, you know, I know where a couple of my weaknesses are. I feel like I know where my strengths are, but where do I begin? You have this, you know, now, you know, two-part manual in front of you. Obviously we've changed it a little bit so that we are doing 4 days and 4 days, but you know, obviously you're starting with section one, but what do you start to focus on first? And so I, you know, I have always said, start where you're comfortable, because you're going to build a plan off of your comfort level that you can adapt into where you feel like you have a weakness. So if your strength is freestyle, which it should be everybody's, and that's now day one, the icebreaker is no longer nutritional, so that we don't have that very difficult, confined, you know, day one of low fat, you know, low salt, you know, cooking with restriction. We wanted to open that door up and let the candidates come in and cook their food from day one. So there is a little bit more comfort level. There is a little bit less ice to break. So start with that, you know, look at that day and look at the expectations of that day and start to develop the foods that you are most proud of, your signature food items. Now, I know that there's a basket that goes with that you're not going to know until, you know, a couple days before the exam, but you still know what your signature starches and vegetables are. You know what you would do with salmon. You know what you would do if we gave you, you know, a Dover sole and some scallops and some shrimp. So there's some of that stuff. Again, you have to take the, you have to kind of take the element of surprise out by knowing and being comfortable with food. I did that through chef's tables, through board dinners, and just working every protein I could get my hands on, any way that I possibly could. So everybody has a different way that they can involve the test into their own lives. You know, and so how to start, I got a binder. I think that it's important to have, you know, a paper trail. If you're more comfortable doing it electronically, that's fine too. But to be able to flip through my notes and to be able to look at what I did for classical and to be able to look at what I did for healthy and freestyle, etc., that was beneficial to me. Drawing the plates that I worked on, writing an honest critique of what I liked or didn't like for each one of those things. And so, you know, it's one day at a time. You need to start with one day at a time. And timed runs are never the first thing. Don't start with a timed run, because you will not have the results that you want, and you'll kind of be working against yourself. I'm a 110% believer that product development has to be the first initial thing. So if you're trying to do global, for instance, you're not going to put yourself through a timed run of, you know, paella and samosas and Cantonese steamed fish, because have you worked on those? Have you cooked all of them 10 times each? Do you know where the pitfalls are going to be? Do you know how you're going to work those in the window, which all have completely different cooking times and applications? So pick the dishes out of those things that you want to focus on and get really comfortable with them and work them into your daily and, you know, your weekly and daily life, not only at work, but also, you know, at home. And that's where I think that sometimes we get a little bit stuck as well, especially this day and age where, you know, we live in a lot more of a convenience world than we used to. When I started cooking, there was no such thing as my chef getting in sides of salmon or portion fish. That was never going to happen. I started off in fabrication. So my day, every day was four lamb racks, chine bone on, fat caps, obviously on a couple, at least two whole lamb saddles, five tenderloins, two strip loins, 15 pounds of whole bone-in trout, and four whole salmon. That was just our standard a la carte setup. That wasn't quails, that wasn't specials, that wasn't all the other things. So as I fabricated, which that took me about an hour and 20 minutes when I got, you know, fairly good at a, you know, as a kid. And so then I would pass all of that product off. The trim from the salmon went to Garmager. The bones from the lamb went to Saucier. You know, there's not that many opportunities out there to cook like that, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is, you know? And so there's plenty of places that still abide by that, and that's fantastic. But we know the vast majority can't afford to run their operations that way. And so if that's you, if you're in that situation, then you need to figure out a way to work that into what you do. You know, we were in that situation as well at my club, where we didn't fabricate everything, but we fabricated a lot. So the places where we weren't, I would work that into a chef's table, into a wine dinner, into employee meal even, you know, and make those things common practice for myself. So if it was something that I hadn't done for a while, I was working it into a system at the club that I could focus on. If it was paella that I needed to focus on, or quails that I needed to focus on, or Cantonese steamed fish that I needed to focus on, I turned that into something that I had to do for work. So I would substitute that out for you know, employee meal or wine dinner or, you know, chef's table, whatever it was. Not necessarily forcing myself into, hey, I have to have this done in 2 hours. More so, I want to understand the purpose of this dish. I want to understand the purpose of paella. I want to know what's going to go wrong and when it's going to go wrong and how I can fix it, if I can fix it. How can I develop a stronger flavor in paella? You know, those things have to be focused on.
And with the portion size now being right around 6, you know, with things like paella or with some of the European cuisine dishes, you can easily do those at home. Invite some company over and cook yourself through those dishes to understand, to read, and really understand the nuance before you're trying to force that into a professional kitchen with a timed run. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunities to cook that food.
There absolutely is. You know, every Wednesday, I think, and Saturday, I removed my cook who was doing employee meal, and I took over employee meals. So that was my opportunity to do a ton of potato samosas. You know, let me do things at my own pace so that I could get it right and so that I could understand it and so that then I could speed up that process when I pushed it into a run. So my weak areas, like if those were my weak areas, my areas I needed to work on, those I put into that. Consommés were on every a la carte menu for years, in some way, shape, or form. And you know, some probably, not going to sell it all. Hey, that's okay. I put my labor, you know, into that. I allocated my day and worked my day so that I was able to do those things. You know, certain things within the entire program aren't a mystery at all. Pastry, for instance, that is airtight months before you step into the exam. So breads, we were running my breads on a la carte menus every Friday and Saturday night. We would run one on Friday, run the other on Saturday, so I could focus on them, work with my baker slash pastry chef. Same thing with my plated dessert. It was on every Friday night as a special. It was marketed as, you know, Chef Hall's CMC dessert or something like that, so that I got buy-in from the membership and I got overwhelmed with orders on purpose. So I had to force myself to really refine those things in a massive quantity that I never would have to do. But I knew that if I could do it that way, it would be a piece of cake, you know, at the test. Same thing with vinaigrettes, marinades, the dessert component for healthy cooking. Those were on all the menus. They were on lunch menus. They were on, you know, nighttime menus. I did healthy cooking a few times for chef's tables where I fit everything into my parameters. I didn't put myself into a time, just made the food work, made it taste good. You know, so there's a lot of opportunity to make those things part of your day-to-day operation. It's up to you to try to find out how that works and what works best. And, you know, obviously, you know, if need be, you know, mention to, you know, your GM, hey, for every board dinner, I want to do tableside work. I don't know if I'm going to get it at the test, but it's going to push me. And so, you know, I did a lot of that stuff as well. We had terrines or pâtés or something on every Sunday brunch. So it just became my day-to-day life. And not that it shouldn't have been to begin with, but, you know, I knew that some of those things weren't going to sell, but there were people who really appreciated that, the ones that did come in to get it, and that got the buy-in, you know, got the board of directors excited about my endeavor to the exam. So I think that there's that approach is different for everybody. It depends on what kind of facility you work in, et cetera, but there's definitely ways in order, if you're not in a place that is doing massive fabrication and pastry work, in order to In order to achieve those goals, there's definitely ways to work it into your daily program.
Well, I think now with how the program is laid out, and there's a great deal of communication about what to expect in the test. Now, there's so many things you can't prepare for, but with all the expectation that's laid out and the familiarity that's required, it's so important to control the variable to ensure that you're working with as few things at the test for the first time as possible. I mean, there may be something, there may be one thing, or there may be a couple things, but the more things you're working with at the test for the first time, the lower your chances of success in the endeavor.
Yeah, we try to take a lot of that guesswork out of it too, so that you're just focused on your food, I think.
I know that was an approach that worked for me. You know, I really did so much of what you were talking about, maybe in some different ways, and didn't exactly execute it the same. But yeah, my goal was to not see anything for the first time at the test.
Yeah, I had a friend who owned a sushi restaurant down the street from the club I was at in Florida, and he always got live eels in. I was never going to get live eels into the club. There was just no way. so I said, hey, you know, next time you're getting eels in, I'd never have done one before. I want to come over in the afternoon and break away and do some eels with you. And, you know, that was right between exams as well. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. You know? So I think that there's, I definitely think there's ways to work this test into all aspects of your life. Like you said, there's plenty of things you can cook at home, given that the volume is a little smaller as far as how many portions you're putting up. Paella is fantastic out on the grill at home. You know, there's a lot of those things that you can really focus on and you know, and track and say, well, this was strong today, this needs work next time, and how you're going to pull those things together. You know, but then also not forgetting all of your staple items, you know, making sure that your staple starches and vegetables and your signature things that you do and want to showcase at the exam are those boxes are checked and that you're comfortable with working them in here and there. So once you have those things together, and I know that sounds like a lot, obviously you can't practice every single food item on the planet. I'm not by no means saying that. I'm saying be comfortable with those fundamentals. Then work it into a full run and evaluate how those dishes compared to doing them at your pace versus putting them into a timed situation, and you'll see a big difference. But it also push you much harder in order to get those things done, and you'll see some big benefits to your cooking by doing it that way. One of the other things that was helpful too with my group that was practicing together is we apprenticed for each other, and so whenever we would have a group get together, you know, we did probably 4 or 5 maybe between 10 and 12. It was pretty much my same little group. We would be each other's apprentice. So while I said earlier, don't use anyone other than a first year culinary student, it was interesting to put one of us in that position, because as the extra set of eyes, having the same knack for this, eye for detail, whatever you want to call it, we were able to find little areas within the program, each other's program, that we were able to suggest to tighten up. You know, right here, it would have helped me if you had this written instead of this. So not that that has to be a thing, but at some point when you put that part to the test with someone who's advanced, you'll be able to find things that you can't see because you're buried. When you have that extra skilled set of eyes as the apprentice for yourself, whether it's a colleague who's doing this and you're practicing with them, you know, or maybe even that advanced person finally from your club or restaurant, that person will be able to see little things that can get tightened up in order to benefit your program and make it very, very strong. That was a huge thing for all of us, I think.
When you get to see so much from both perspectives of how you can better work with an apprentice, and then you have somebody who's doing the work of the apprentice, and they can give you some real feedback about how, you know, some things that you're missing or some things that you can see them that would benefit them. Or like you said, you know, hey, look, if you put it here, I could see this better. And you can really, you get a chance, especially if you never apprenticed for the exam, to see what it's really like to do so.
Yeah, it's a whole nother vantage point because, you know, us, my group, we were so caught up in doing what we do each time we stepped in. We never really even thought about that till I think it was, you know, Steven Genta again, who suggested that we apprentice for each other. And it just was like a wow thing, you know, to have your good friends who you respect and love and know their food and how strong you watch them cook. Then when you're that person apprenticing or vice versa, you just are really able to, you know, help them build and them help you build a whole new level to your system.
Beautiful. I know it made a difference for me when we were doing it, when I was practicing and getting to see the development or even working side by side and tasting and, you know, developing flavor or finishing. And, you know, it gave us with, you know, some of the people that I was preparing for with the test, you know, it gave us an opportunity to, you know, to talk about, hey, you know, did you ever, you know, do this for flavor enhancing or, you know, how would you approach this ingredient? That was, you know, training with somebody, it's always a slippery slope, right? It's, I don't want to say it's dangerous, but you know, it's not a team sport, the exam, but at the same time, you can do a lot of work together and be more effective, right? Like if you're both doing the same market basket and you write that separately, there's an opportunity there for a real cool conversation to say, oh, well, I didn't think about that. Or, you know, why did you use those ingredients that way? Definitely think it's not best to compare notes at the test. But when you're getting ready for the test, I think having an alternative thought process, one that, you know, somebody who has a similar skill set and somebody who, you know, works very effectively, a good candidate on your level, you can have some really constructive development.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique thing. Like you said, you know, we tied together pretty strong and we were there to give each other support if something happened, but it's you're definitely on your own once you step into those doors. But you can cover a lot more ground in the lead up to it by working together and by researching things together and by, you know, focusing on the goal and just talking about food. It really is a great opportunity.
I think this is probably the best place for us to stop, and we'll pick up again in the next episode.
Hi, my name is Jason Hall. I'm the president of AMCO, or the American Master Chef's Order. Some history on AMCO. It was formed in 2014 by a group of master chefs, including Bill Franklin, who spearheaded this concept. The idea was to look at the brand, see how we can further develop it and develop the exam going forward to meet ever-changing needs within the industry, to offer a coming together of our guild once you've passed the exam on the other side, and then also to start to develop the training and support needed for candidates as they approach the exam. Our mission is to promote, sustain, and perfect our craft, all while identifying and supporting and inspiring the next generation of candidates as they progress towards becoming an American Master Chef. You can reach us and see more information on our website at AmericanMasterChef'sOrder.org. Thank you.
Please subscribe or share if any of this information has impacted you in a positive way. I'd like to thank you very much for your participation and joining us in. For any resources discussed during the course of the podcast, please check the AMCO website, AmericanMasterChef'sOrder.com, to find it there.
On behalf of AMCO, I would like to thank everyone for listening today.